Morning, everybody.
Morning.
Some of us are in retreat, and some of you are not in retreat, meaning that you've just come to listen to my talk, listen to the talk. So this retreat, for those of you who don't know, is the Rahatsu Sesshin, and people sit in meditation here from 1 day to 7 days, and this is our second day, celebration of Buddha's enlightenment. Buddha's enlightenment. And we supposedly, although it's just a myth, sit the way he sat. But myths are cool. Myths are cool. And we get enlightened just like he did by doing what he did. So we celebrate it, and we experience it, and we enlighten him by doing it. This isn't about some big experience of enlightenment. This is about learning to live lightly. That's what it's about, learning to live lightly. And those of you who are in retreat may think, it's sure not about living lightly. It's heavy. It's heavy. It's painful. It's disturbing. It's confusing. It's pissing and moaning. How do you learn to live lightly by doing this? I have no idea. I don't know how you do it. I don't know how it happens. Nobody ever told me how. We're always interested in how, right? How? I don't know. Yesterday I was talking about my teacher, Shinryu Suzuki Roshi. He's up there someplace, right, Ben? Oh, Ben's not here. Oh, there's his picture. It's his 40th anniversary of his death today. He's up there next to the flowers, his visage. And, geez, I must be old. Eric, we must be old.
Older than you.
Because we hung out with him when we were young. We hung out. And yesterday I was talking about, I think I better get my watch out, because for those of you who are have just come in, it would be rude to keep you all morning into the afternoon. So yesterday I was talking about Suzuki's son. This is the Suzuki of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, who was virtual unknown when Eric and I hung out with him, but because of our countenance, he became very famous, right, Eric? Because of our practice, he became the most famous Soto teacher in the United States. Because of us. We enlighten, they enlighten us. Reciprocal. Everything's reciprocal. Everything's turning. Let's just get with it. Let's just get with it. What's happening? That's all we have to do. Nothing to it. But it's very heavy at first. It seems very heavy because all this stuff comes up, all these worries, all this pain, all this commotion. How can that be light? Where's the lightness there? Well, I don't know. I don't know. At some point, it's very light. Now, Suzuki Roshi's son, I was talking about him yesterday, Otohiro, the barber. He had two sons. One was a Zen teacher and one was a barber. I don't know if the barber is... Yeah, I think the barber is talked about in the book. Otohiro's son, the barber, I was saying yesterday, I was saying to him something like, oh, your father. Your father, you know. He is so, so fluid. And so available to life and so not stuck on things. And Otohiro said, "Oh, is that what Otohiro said?" Oh, let's hear that again. Otohiro, what a reincarnation from barber, from being a barber. So Otohiro said, "Oh, I said, I remember his anger. I remember his shouting. I remember." And then I said, "Well, how old were you?" He said, "Oh, I was very young. He doesn't seem to be like that anymore." He said, "Something changed. I don't know what changed. I have no idea. But it was not easy then. But now, he seems like a different man. I don't know. I don't know," he said. "I don't know." We don't know. We don't poke our heads into it. We don't try to figure it out. The mind always wants to figure things out, wants to figure out how it's making progress and how this meditation is really, really changing us, really transforming us. Fuck that. Fuck that. The mind's not going to be able to do anything other than just create more and more commotion and confusion. That's the nature of the mind. Well, that's this is before my talk's even started. It's already 10 after, so I got to pay attention to my watch. Okay, so today I want to talk about directness and simplicity. Directness and simplicity. Key components of Zen, right? In Zen, we stress no intermediaries. Everything is just what it is. Fingernails are fingernails. Clean fingernails are clean fingernails. Dirty nails, fingernails are dirty fingernails. Everything is just what it is. Toilet paper is toilet paper. This is building on yesterday. I won't get into this too much. Toilet paper is toilet paper. A shit stick is a shit stick. Matt's smile is Matt's smile. Everything is what it is. No intermediaries. We're always interjecting a commentary. We're always interjecting a pissing and moaning or a trying to get something or a comparison. But is it possible? Is it possible to let go of all that intermediary stuff? Is it possible? Is it possible? And then you start carrying yourself lightly, more lightly. But you don't look into it. You don't compare. It just kind of happens. Just kind of happens. I, Echo, this is a student, Echo, from China, Chinese Zen student, ask you, Hogan is the teacher. I'm going to wait and let these folks come in. You know, they can come in here if they want. Lee, why don't you help them come in here?
Come in here.
So a Zen student Echo and his teacher Hogan. I, Echo, ask you, what is the Buddha? Hogan answered, "You are Echo." You are Echo. Direct, simple. Nothing more, nothing less. Not trying to put a head on top of this perfectly good head we have already. You are Echo. You are it. You are what you are. I am what I am. No intermediary. No trying to wish and plan and get confused about it, how it should be different. The wishing and the planning comes up, but it's not something that interferes with directness. With directness, because we don't identify with it. We identify with this. With this. So be directly who we are. That's what this teaching is about. And at first, it doesn't seem like it works at all. At second, maybe it doesn't seem like it works at all either. Or maybe at third. But finally, we're just directly who we are. We just are. So Suzuki Roshi story. So Suzuki Roshi, this is a story you guys, some of you have heard many, many times. He was very absent-minded. He was so absent-minded that he went off with my glasses one time, thinking they were his own. And I went looking for them, went back to Zen Center, said, where are those? Linda said, oh, you just left them someplace. But he had taken them up to his room thinking they were his. He came down, he said, oh, are these your glasses? Very lightly, very lightly. And then his problem, he lost his glasses all the time. So he said, I'm buying glasses at Woolworths. Do they still have Woolworths? Maybe they don't. You know, what's the equivalent of Woolworths now?
Walgreens,
okay. I can buy them for $10. And just then I strap them on around my head in the back. Then I can buy lots of pairs because so. So here is this Zen teacher who's teaching mindfulness. This mindful Zen teacher. Oh, the perfection of Zen. But he just was who he was. He didn't hide it. He just was who he was. We're always hiding because we want to be someone different. We want to be the person that our parents thought we should be, or that we think we should be, or that our spouse thinks that we should be. Instead of just being who we are. Immediacy. When the mind stills, we enjoy immediacy. We appreciate immediacy. It's not something we even need to cultivate. And at some point, the mind actually does still, you guys. It does it on its own. I guarantee, but I'm not giving you any money. And I won't give you your money back either. You may have to spend a lot of pain and a lot of money. That's all right. Spend it all. Spend it all. If you want to live lightly, you have to spend. You have to give. If you want to develop the effervescence of Zen. Okay? So, how do we practice? How do we do Zen practice? Well, we say Zen practice, we want to live lightly. If we want to live immediately, directly in the world, simply in the world, without all this getting all entangled by stuff, what do? We do two types of things in Zen. We don't let intellect dictate. We put in our retreats, in our sitting, even if it's a 30-minute sitting, a 40-minute sitting, a 20-minute sitting, a 7-day sitting, we put the mind in a straitjacket. No wonder the mind pisses and moans. No wonder it feels heavy. Kadagiri used to call this putting the snake in the bamboo pole. Remember? Putting the snake in the bamboo pole. At some point, I don't know when, the snake gets very calm. It just gets, but the snake hates being in a bamboo pole at first. It hates it. At some point, it becomes very calm. This is what we do in Zen. This is what we do. So don't give up too easily, please. Don't give up too easily. The other thing we do is we follow Confucius, Zen Master Confucius's advice. The famous Zen master, who said, the superior man, in all things, he does his utmost. The superior woman, in all things, she does her utmost. That's immediate. We just do our utmost. We don't know what we're doing. If we're going to the toilet, if we're walking upstairs, if we're washing the dishes, we give ourselves. And we don't burn out if we do this immediately. We burn out by thinking about it, by worrying about it, by hoping and fearing about it. You don't burn out if you give yourself to this. You just don't. You just don't. It doesn't happen. You get a lot of energy. A lot of energy. So the handmaiden of directness is an appreciation of plainness and simplicity. Plainness and simplicity. So when I started, when I was a young man and I was deciding where I was going to practice in San Francisco, I went to the Vedanta temple because I was, Zen. Well, I won't get into that. I went to the Vedanta temple because I was very interested in the Vedas and very interested in Ramakrishna and that practice, that great Advaita, A-D-V-A-I-T-A, non-dualistic Vedanta, and Ramakrishna and Vivekananda and all that stuff. I liked going there, but they had a lot of stuff around the walls, a lot of stuff, a lot of guru stuff and elaborate stuff. And then I went to another part of San Francisco, to Tolong's Chinese Zen temple. And that Chinese Zen temple, they had dragons on the walls. And they had intricate paintings all over the place where you were sitting in Zazen, where you were sitting in meditation. And then I went to Zen Center. Zen Center, there was the hardwood floor. There were beautiful bare walls. There was a ceiling like this. Simplicity, directness. The floors show us how to live. They show us how to live in their grain, just expressing their grain. We can express our grain too, the same way they do, only completely different. Completely different. But we appreciate the floor for what it is, for what it shows itself. Just its life. It's our life. It's our heart. It's our soul. So I had to go to Zen because that's what I liked. But I did go back to the Vedanta's temple in Tolong when I got tired of Suzuki. this bamboo pole thing can get tedious. It's nice to have some breaks from the bamboo pole, some nice dragons on the walls and gurus to help you and stuff like that. So whenever I could, I snuck out and went to those places. But I never told Suzuki, of course. That's authentic, isn't it? So the handmaiden of directness, plainness and simplicity. Usually, as Ralph Waldo Emerson said, things are in the saddle and ride mankind. They ride us. Things ride us. They ride us. They wear us down. We're worn down. Now, Americans in particular, but the Chinese now, if you look about what's happening to Chinese culture, they're starting to get worn down by things. Things. So I'll talk about Steve Jobs for a minute. It's only 20 after. See, I'm paying attention to the time. Steve Jobs. I've talked about Steve Jobs before, but I'll say a little bit more. So Steve Jobs, practiced Zen a little. I don't know how much. He was kind of a cranky asshole, so we hate to say that he practiced too much, but he might have practiced for years. I don't know. I know some people who have practiced for years and are cranky assholes. My wife even thinks that I could be one of them. It's true. Ask her. And then she talks to me, and she said, "And you teach mindfulness?" That's what she says. She said, "Boy, she's what a deal, huh?" What a deal. What did I get myself into? What do we get ourselves into with all these social obligations? And all these obligations to, keep relationships going and be good in our bamboo poles. Steve Jobs. So Steve Jobs, you know, I haven't read the book, his biography yet, so I probably don't know the same things you guys know. A lot of people who've read his biography, but I do know that he practiced with Kobenchino Roshi, Kobenchino Sensei, whom I practice with too. And I do know that he practiced in Los Altos Zendo, which was actually in the San Francisco Peninsula. It was a group that Suzuki and Roshi and I started. But by the time he started practicing there, I was long gone and Suzuki was longer gone. And he was married by Kobenchino, too. I haven't seen the picture, but I think Rosemary, did you send me a picture or show me a picture of him getting married? Oh, yeah. Well, anyway, there's a picture of him getting married by Kobenchino. Kobenchino died. He was drowned in Switzerland, saving his children who had fallen in a river. But he was one of my early friends and teachers. Anyway, so Steve Jobs' focus was on decluttering the world. Well, of course, when you look at it, you think, but that was his intent. His intent was to declutter the world of high-tech gadgetry. And his intent was to do products that exemplified minimalist design and simplicity. Minimalist design and simplicity. And it worked because people are drawn to that kind of thing. They're drawn to that kind of thing. He married aesthetics to engineering. And it hadn't been done. It just hadn't been done. And either Steve Jobs said or someone said, I don't know, Apple products are as defined by what they're missing as much as by what they contain. Ooh. Deep. Deep. And, well, we have an Apple store just about 3 blocks from us now, right? And when I go by that Apple store, I remind myself that Steve Jobs was really interested in the design of his stores. He was a little bit OCD, you know, and he was very interested in the design. He wanted the design to be simple. He wanted the floors and the ceilings to speak simplicity, directness, openness, the windows. So if you go to that Apple store, just 3 blocks from here, you'll see how he attempted to bring that aesthetic into his stores and into his products, which is the Zen aesthetic. But let's not get hung up on it, really. Let's not get hung up on it. So to appreciate simplicity. Oh, here's another Steve Jobs quote that I'm going to do, you guys, that I did once before, but I like it. He discusses his quest for beauty and simplicity. For him, simplicity was beauty. Again, from Zen, simplicity is beauty. Something that's simple speaks. And you feel calm and you feel connected with something simple. It helps your mind get calm, actually, when things are simple. So he discusses his quest for simplicity and beauty. And here's what he says. For the past 33 years, I have looked in the mirror every morning and asked myself, if today were the last day of my life, would I want to do what I am about to do today? And whenever the answer has been no for too many days in a row, I know I need to change something. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way to avoid the trap of thinking you have something to lose. You're already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart. Directness, simplicity. So our practice of meditation, our practice of Zen meditation is an emptying, a gradual emptying, so we can appreciate simplicity and so we can manifest it. A monk asked Baijiang, what is the most wonderful thing in the world? And Baijiang said, sitting alone on this marvelous peak, sitting alone on this sublime peak. The monk bowed. And Baijiang struck him. What's the deal there? Well, since we don't know what the deal is, I get to say whatever I want, right? That's cool about these stories, right? No
Nobody knows. You know, these guys probably just all had too much sake. We're going to drink sake today with my friend here. Because my friend... let me see if I can get his picture down here. I don't know. My friend and mentor, Shinryu Suzuki Roshi, in those days, we just sat all the time. You know, we didn't have regular jobs and go to school and stuff like that. This was the 60s, you know. We just sat all the time. So we got up on New Year's Day, and we would always sit. Always go over to Zen Center and sit every New Year's Day. And, the first New Year's Day, we did our morning sitting just like we do here. We did a 40-minute sitting, and then a 10-minute kin-in, and then another 40-minute sitting. Then we did our service. And I didn't remember it was New Year's Day, but then Suzuki got out the sake. And we all drank sake. So we're going to drink sake with him today. Those of you who aren't retreat, you don't get sake. you can go get your own sake. Go get your own sake. Well, that's how we're going to celebrate his the 40th anniversary of his death. A monk asked Paijang, sitting alone, asked Paijang, what's the most important thing in the world? What's the most wonderful thing in the world? Sitting alone on this sublime peak. This is the sublime peak. This is a peak. This peak is here. The mountain is your legs, and you're sitting alone in the Zendo. You're sitting with stillness. You may feel lonely sometime, but let that loneliness fade into great aloneness, great spaciousness, completely alone, nobody can help you, nobody can give you anything. Go into that deeper and deeper until you see only you alone and sacred, only you alone and sacred. 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 Nobody can do it for you. Nobody can help you. Only you alone and sacred. The most wonderful thing in the world. Sitting alone on this sublime peak. Even though I can't sit half lotus anymore. It doesn't matter. There are all kinds of mountains, all shapes of mountains. You can always sit alone on this peak. A monk asked Paijang, what's the most wonderful thing in the world? Paijang said, sitting alone on this sublime peak. The monk bowed, and Paijang struck him. How rude! How rude! So my interpretation of this is, the monk was... Paijang was showing him something. He was opening his heart to him. He was saying, here it is. Sit alone with it. Return to your original stillness right now. I can't help you. Just go into it. And he did the social convention of bowing. Well, that's okay, but that's an intermediary. That's an intermediary if you just do it as a convention because you're trying to be honorific or do what's right. Fuck what's right. Fuck what's right. Be here. Be here. Be here. The monk asked Paijang, what is the most wonderful thing in the world? Paijang said, sitting alone on this sublime peak. You don't need anything more. You don't need to bow or not bow or think about it or try to get it or try to be grateful or wish you were grateful and you just want to get out of here. Right? You don't need to do any of that stuff. That's extra. That's intermediary stuff. Jeez, we waste our fucking lives, don't we? Our lives go by year after year. Problem after problem, and we miss stuff. We miss this, but here it is. It's always available. So even though we may have missed it for the last 32 years, here it is. Here it is. So the Zen teacher Taibya died in 1842, says, to a man who has not eaten a globefish, we cannot speak of its flavor. So this is about eating the globefish. This is what we do. We eat the globefish. We don't think about eating it. We eat it. That's our practice. We actually do it. And the globefish is a fish, I am told, this is a reading that I've done, the globefish is considered very, very tasty delicacy. So this is a very tasty delicacy, sitting and settling into this great aloneness that includes all life. The taste of this aloneness that includes everything is beyond anything that we can imagine. Beyond anything. And the taste is right here. Right here, not someplace else. On the other hand, the globefish also has a little bit of poison in it. It has a little bit of poison in it. And if you're going to eat a globefish, you should know that you might get an upset stomach. You might vomit. It's going to be very tasty, but there's a little bit of poison in it. So that's our practice. That's our practice. There's a little bit of poison in just being with, in stillness, with all the stuff that comes up, all the thoughts and the concerns, all the worries that come up, and just sitting here, moment after moment. Day after day, year after year, poison comes up, poison comes through. Of course, because we're available. We're not hiding from it. We're not therapizing it. We're just letting it come up. Letting it come up. And we taste the wonderful flavor of the globefish. And so the poison comes up and it passes through. But the globefish enlightens us. We need that to be fully alive. There's always some poison. There's always some poison. But the poison is just passes through. Just nobody gets really sick from the globefish. Just a little bit of nausea sometimes. A little diarrhea. A little nausea, a little diarrhea, Just get plenty of toilet paper, You'll be fine. So I say over and over again, in Soto Zen, or not Rinzai, we're Soto, the barrier is the gateway. The barrier is the gateway. That's just what it is. So the stuff comes up when we're in our sitting, and we just sit with it. We just breathe. We may come back and say something to ourselves to help us, some mantra or some little phrase to help us with our breathing. That's good. But just stay with it. Just stay with it. So this is the art of Zen transformation, but without trying to transform anything. If you try to transform it, you will run away from this practice and say, oh, enough! Enough! I'm not making any progress. I'm only regressing. Well, that's good. That's cool. Regress. Regress. Why not? Regress to the root. To sitting alone on this marvelous peak. The root of life. And in Zen, we're also suspicious of abstraction. We're kind of suspicious of abstraction. People come to me and want to talk to me about karma and what the real meaning of karma is and what its implications are and how Buddhist karma works. I'm not very interested. I try to be nice to them, but that doesn't interest me very much. It's like it gets into big head stuff, Big head stuff. everything is the cause of everything else, and everything is the effect of everything else. Period. Period. I'm sorry. I ain't going there. I ain't going there. Everything is the cause of everything else, and everything is the effect of everything else. But you want to go there because you want to get it figured out. I know. You want to have a better life. Yes, everybody wants to get it figured out and have a better life. But don't waste much time on that if you're a Zen student. Instead, eat the globefish. That's where you'll find your power, in the globefish. That's where you'll find your true psychedelic power, in the globefish. Or people ask me about what's the relation between Zazen and compassion? Does sitting really promote compassion? How does it promote compassion? Why aren't people who sit more compassionate? Etc. Well, I'm not very interested in that stuff, you guys. You can talk to me about it, but I might probably go to sleep. What? Well, I much prefer William Blake. I much prefer William Blake. William Blake says, He who would do good to another must do it in minute particulars. General good is the realm of the scoundrel, hypocrite, and flatterer. That's right. Most of religion is about this, you guys. Don't do this kind of religion. Don't do it. Don't do this kind of religion. Really. It's stupid and fake. And it just gets your head big. You don't need a big head. Your head is so huge already. Give it a break. Give it a break. Give your poor head a break. So I have a relative, and I'm not going to name this person because I'm embarrassed I've talked so much about this relative. Actually, I'm going to change it now because I'm embarrassed in front of this relative. This relative is long dead, but it still embarrasses me. My great uncle George. My great uncle George from the Catholic side of my family. I have an Irish Catholic side of my family, the Timothy side. My great uncle George went to Mass every day. And he was always trying to help humanity. He was on the Hollister School Board, Hollister, California, where I'm from. He was helping indigent people come over from China. He helped people settle in San Francisco. He was doing many things. And he always was telling us about what he was doing. When people tell you about what they do, you begin to smell some odor, don't you? Begin to wonder, what's the deal here? He was always telling us about what he was doing. And then there were his sons. There were his sons. And he was ignoring his own sons, doing all this good for humanity. He was ignoring his sons. He was not there for them because he was too interested in being a humanitarian. We do this, don't we? We do this in our big-headedness. And we forget right in front of us our own sons, our own daughters, our own wives, our own kitty cats. That's not authentic. He was not authentic. He was caught by some idea of being a good Catholic. Right? Don't get caught by this good Buddha shit. Don't get caught by it. It just ruin your life. Of course, there are lots of ways to ruin your life. So maybe this good Buddha shit is a fine way. It's as good a way as any to ruin your life. So go ahead. Go ahead. Good Buddhist, good Catholic, who cares? Right? Good Unitarian. Good Unitarian. You think, oh, they're beyond that. No. Not so. I was raised one. I can tell you, I'll give you a whole talk on that. Whole talk on that. So let's see. Oh, the history of Zen. The history of Zen. Is This history of Zen starts with Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma says, this will take 92 minutes. You guys, I hope you ate well. No, if you ate globefish, you don't have to eat anything else. If you didn't have any globefish this morning, maybe Martin will have to bring in snacks. Or Stacy. Stacy, do you have snacks?
I don't have any snacks on me.
Well, how about the sake for later?
I'm not going to tell you where it is.
Okay, well, I have to do a short history of Zen. So the Emperor Wu said to Bodhidharma, what's the first principle of your holy teaching? And Bodhidharma said, a vast spaciousness with nothing holy about it. A vast emptiness with nothing holy about it. So that's how Zen starts. That's the beginning of Zen. Although Bodhidharma, we knew Bodhidharma existed, but we're actually not sure if he really said that. But in Zen mythology, that's the history of Zen. That's the beginning of Zen. And then shortly thereafter, within 100 years, this vast spaciousness with nothing holy about it turns into Buddha as a tree in the garden, Buddha as a shit stick, Buddha as 10 pounds of flax, Buddha as toilet paper, Buddha as kicks and blows. Because, you know, these Chinese guys are always giving kicks and blows to each other. In a kind of Laurel and Hardy way. So that's interesting, isn't it? We start with spaciousness. And then we appreciate everything as it is. Directly through spaciousness. Through emptying out and forgetting about this holy fucking stuff. We see everything as it is. It's holy because it exists. But it's not holy. It's just alive. Completely alive. So round, so alive, so open, so transformative that poor little intellect can't get its teeth into it. Oh, poor intellect. Oh, poor Tim. Oh, poor Matt. Become very poor, you guys. Become very poor, and you will appreciate this. Become poorer than you ever imagined, and you will appreciate this globefish. You will appreciate this shit stick, this microphone, just as it is, without an intermediary. You have to become that poor. That poor. So, Buddha started out supposedly looking for the meaning of life. What was the meaning of life? But then things changed, right? And a lot of us get into Zen practice looking for the meaning of life. And you know, I saw a Woody Allen retrospective last week on TV. Did anybody see that? Anybody see that? It was great, especially if you're a Woody Allen fan. But maybe if you're even not a Woody Allen fan, it was great. And most of Woody Allen's movies are about the angst that his characters feel about the meaning of life. It's the angst that they feel about, what am I doing here? Shouldn't I be doing something different? Is there a greater, higher power? Can I connect to that? Why am I so stuck in my fears? You know those Woody Allen characters, on and on and on again. And you know, we don't ever seem to tire of them. I mean, how long has he been doing this now? When did he do those first movies? 30 years? How old is he now? Huh? 40 years, yeah. We don't seem to tire of this stuff because it's a human situation. We see in all these characters our situation. Wanting some meaning, and yet anxious and tied in knots, so I love seeing that retrospective. I love seeing it. But his characters do what human beings all do, is that we turn our vital energy of our Buddha nature into what? Into negativity and doubt. We turn this pristine energy, which is directly available to us, into negativity and doubt. That's why we have to do this practice of sitting, to see the negativity and the doubt, and not to begin to disidentify with it. Begin to just disidentify with it. Sitting alone on this marvelous peak. So the meaning of life isn't very important in Zen. Not very important. But what is important is how we harmonize ourselves with others, with each of us. How we harmonize ourselves in a world of misunderstanding, in a world of deceit, in a world of violence. When we're full of that, all that stuff ourselves, we're full of that same stupidity, that same insincerity, that same cruelty, and that same sloth. Any of you in retreat feeling slothful? Or you'd like to be slothful. You just like to get out of here so you can go be slothful at home. After all, it's Sunday. Jeez. And those of you who aren't in retreat, you don't even have to worry about it. You can go be slothful for the rest of the day. But this is our practice. How do we harmonize ourselves with each other? How do we return to just directly being with each other? Directly feeling each other's pain and each other's love, so that we can show them our love. We can show them our affection. How do we do that? Well, this is how we do it. This is how we do it. We do it just the way I was saying. We put our snakes in a bamboo pole, and we, in all things, we do our utmost. We do our utmost. We don't hesitate. We just do our utmost. So now I'm going to tell one last story. I guess I'll have to do the history of Zen tomorrow when I have a captive audience who can't go away. One last story. Okay, so one last story about directness and simplicity. Okay, so I used to work as a therapist. I was never a good therapist. I was not a well-trained therapist, but I did it anyway. Sometimes we do things that we're not good at. It's cool. You know, don't worry about whether you're good at something. If you want to do something, go into it. Eat the globefish. It was very good for me to eat that globefish. Very good for me. But I never got good like some of my other friends, my wife in particular. You know, spouses always compare. They're always comparing. Anyway, we forgot that. But you know, I don't remember very many of my clients, luckily. Well, because clients come in with pain, you know, they come in with pain. And so it's not that they, I don't mean to be rude, but you know, it's not stuff you want to carry around. But I remember one client in particular. And this was a Down syndrome client that I had, and his name was David. And I have talked about him before. I don't know how many times. In 10 years, I probably talked about him 3 times before. I don't know. I have no idea. David. So David had lots of issues and lots of problems, and he was a high-functioning Down syndrome guy, you know, really good verbal skills. So he really benefited from therapy. You know how I remember him? Well, when it was time for him to come in, like maybe the second or third time I saw him, you know, as a therapist, I would have my door closed. One client would leave, and then I would keep my door closed. I'd get maybe 3 minutes, you know, 4 minutes. Therapists always seem so composed, but in those 4 minutes, we're just trying to do a little breathing. 5 minutes. Charting. We have to chart. Oh, I won't get into all that stuff. and then I would open the door. So after on the third time, I opened the door. And, you know, out in my waiting room, I had a little pot of water, you know, hot water, where you could make, you could do tea or coffee. So about the third time, I was seeing David. I opened the door. You know, he was my eighth client or something for the day, and there was David with a cup of tea. You know, that he, and he said, "Tim, want tea? Want tea?" And I said, "Well, thank you, David." Here I'd been a therapist in that office for several years. Nobody had ever thought to bring me tea. Nobody had ever thought to reach out to me. But David, directly, simply, saw the tea bags, put the tea in. He said, "Like peppermint?" I said, "Yeah, I like peppermint." It really wasn't my favorite, but I was so excited that he was doing that. "Yeah, I like peppermint." And I like peppermint okay. So then, you know, it became a ritual, right? But every time he did it the first time. It was his first time. "Like tea? Peppermint today?" And yes, I always took the peppermint. I always loved the peppermint. The peppermint became some kind of tea that I'd never had before. You know, when something does, someone gives you something with affection, someone gives you something wholeheartedly, that food all of a sudden becomes like the richest feast that you've ever had. Do you know what I mean? The richest fucking feast. Wow. Who can beat that? Directness. Simplicity. Okay, well, please continue this practice. And if you're staying, just stay. If you're staying, just stay. And if you're going, just go. Do you understand what I mean? Don't just completely go. Completely go. With nothing else but going. And if you're staying, just stay. With nothing else but staying. Nada, nada, nada. Can you do that? Can you do that? You can. You can. Yes, sir. Good for you. Good for you. But don't let it go to your head.